Can you manage your own blood pressure?
Transmission of the MERS virus.
Can we treat depression in teenagers more effectively?
Looking at the cardiovascular risk versus the income in countries around the world.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on August 29th, 2014. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and president of the Texas Tech University Health Science Center, El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think I'm very intrigued by the idea that people can go home and manage their own high blood pressure. That's in the Journal of the American Medical Association. They sent a bunch of older people out and said, hey, these are the factors, here's the medicines. What happened?
By the time we're 80 years old, about 80% of the population will have hypertension. Around the world, self-monitoring of blood pressure has been fairly common. For example, if you go to the United Kingdom, about a third of people self-monitor or take their own blood pressure measurements. And since people are getting their blood pressures, can they actually begin to manage their own hypertension? And that's what this study addressed. They took 552 patients. They had one or more risk factors for cardiovascular disease. For example, they had kidney disease, or they had cardiovascular disease that was known, or diabetes. So these are high-risk individuals. And they randomized them to this usual care or on a program where the patients took their blood pressure measurements and they already had an algorithm that told them to either increase or decrease medications and which ones to do that. And they followed these individuals over the course of a year. And what they found is that the individuals who did their own management of their medications and their home blood pressure measurements had a markedly lower blood pressure than those that had usual care. When I say markedly lower, the systolic pressure was lower by about 9 millimeters of mercury, the diastolic by about 3 millimeters of mercury, and that's thought to represent, if you follow these individuals out, would result in a 30% decreased risk of significant cardiovascular events. So this is great news.
It is really great news. As you know, I'm such a fan of people really becoming very participatory in their own care. Clearly, this is an example of that. Were there any deleterious consequences as a result of this self-management?
There were no increased adverse events. But in fairness, only about 5% of individuals were included in the study. They did not include people that had terminal illnesses or people that had any cognitive dysfunction or people that weren't motivated. It's estimated that fewer than 20% of all people around the country would fall into this category.
Was this in a population in whom hypertension was the only condition that was on board?
No, these are people that could have chronic kidney disease or diabetes or known cardiovascular disease.
Certainly we've seen this model in the past when we've taken a look at, for example, Coumadin and people being able to participate in their own care with regard to titrating that medication. So I think it's a great model and I think it's wonderful if we can educate people and get them motivated for them to really become a part of that.
Yeah, for the carefully selected patients, it can be very helpful.
So since we're talking about cardiovascular risk factors then, why don't we turn to the New England Journal of Medicine, a look at cardiovascular events in low, middle, and high-income countries.
What this study did was they enrolled over 156,000 persons from more than 600 urban and rural communities in 17 different countries. Three of them were high-income countries, 10 were middle-income countries, and four were considered low-income countries. And they did two things. One is they assessed what their cardiovascular risk factors were. And then they followed them for 4 years to look at the number of events these individuals might have. They found that the cardiovascular risk score was highest in individuals that were in high-income countries. However, the rates of cardiovascular events were actually lower in the high-income countries. Individuals in low-income countries were three times more likely to suffer a cardiovascular fatality than people in high-income countries.
All right. And our speculation is that all of us in these high-income countries are getting good management and prophylaxis?
Well, that's the hypothesis. In fact, when you look at the use of preventative medications and you look at the use of revascularization procedures, they're significantly more common in high-income countries. Now, when you look at urban versus rural, in high-income countries, there was really no significant difference in the event rates. But when you got to middle or low-income countries, people lived in urban centers were more likely to do better than those that lived in the more rural areas.
I guess this sounds a note of warning, doesn't it? Because we know that we are exporting our lifestyle, we're exporting our really pathetic diet in lots of ways and increasing the risk for folks in middle and low-income countries without really providing much of a care model that can be exported as well.
And that tells us what we need to do is we need to begin to export our preventative measures and proven pharmacology as well. We need to make it accessible and we need to make it economically feasible as well.
Since we're in the New England Journal of Medicine, then let's turn to something that's rather interesting. And that was a study taking a look at MERS, which fell off the radar for lots of people now that we have Ebola and chikungunya occupying everyone's attention. But this one is a look at household contacts and how contagious is this anyway?
MERS stands for the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. It's a pneumonia or a viral illness caused by a coronavirus. It was first described in 2012 from a patient that had fatal pneumonia in Saudi Arabia. But over the subsequent 2 years, there have been at least 834 laboratory confirmed cases of MERS. About a third of those individuals died. What we don't know is how transmissible this particular virus is. So here's how the study was done. They identified 26 patients that had known MERS infection. They subsequently made contact with their 280 household members. And of the household contacts, for those that had been exposed within 2 weeks, they took nasal swabs and did specific tests looking for the virus. And for those individuals who were identified later than 2 weeks, they actually looked for different antibodies in the blood system. And using that, what they determined of the 26 index patients, there were 12 probable causes of secondary transmission. That is a rate of about 4%. Now, here's the interesting thing. These were all people that had no symptoms, or in one case, just a mild sore throat. As a result, these individuals can become contacts for further infections if not identified ahead of time.
These studies are always sort of interesting, I think, because I think what they demonstrate is the fact that we see people clinically who are really desperately ill, in some cases dying or requiring admission to an ICU. But in fact, there's an awful lot of people out there who have subclinical disease who aren't identified.
The initial infection is thought to be from camels. There was another outbreak where they couldn't identify contact with the animal. But what they did do is identify contact with asymptomatic individual. The nice thing is there's a low transmission rate, but we need to be vigilant is when we identify individuals with it, is to screen their contacts, because many of them may be carriers of the disease for a short period of time without any subsequent symptoms.
And certainly that's a lesson that's very apt right now worldwide. Finally then, let's go back to the Journal of the American Medical Association, a look at, can we treat depression in adolescents more effectively?
You know, I was surprised to know that about 1 in 9 U.S. adolescents experience an episode of depression before they turn 18 years of age. That was surprising to me. And in fact, the World Health Organization ranks depression as the leading cause of illness and disability for 10 to 19-year-old youth worldwide. The fact that it's so prevalent has made the USPSTF recommend screening for depression in adolescents. Well, once you've identified it, the question is, what do you do about it? So this was a study that looked at the ability to use collaborative care associated with a primary care physician or pediatrician to address depression in the primary care setting. It took adolescents determined to have depression, 50 who were randomized to receive usual care, and 51 who were randomized to receive collaborative care, care delivered by a depression care manager. That was a master's level clinician who had experience with dealing with that. They visited with the patient and with the parents, and they offered CBT, they offered pharmacotherapy, or the combination of those two agents. And then they followed up with the patient subsequently over the next several weeks and months. And what they determined was that by 12 months, those that received the collaborative care were doing much better. About 67% of those who received the collaborative care had some response, and 50% were in complete remission. That's as opposed to the usual care, where only about 38% showed some response and 20% showed a remission.
Boy, that's really remarkable, isn't it? And it certainly argues for a very persuasive case for the inclusion of someone to help manage this depression in adolescents. We know, of course, it's such a huge risk factor for suicide.
Yeah, and the major issues associated with depression in adolescents, you mentioned suicide, obesity, and also high-risk behaviors such as substance abuse. And we didn't mention the fact that the cost for this was about $1,400 per adolescent.
And I guess another thing that's worth mentioning is the fact that when people experience an episode of depression really early in life, we know that many of them experience subsequent episodes that are more prolonged and more challenging to try to overcome.
And one of the reasons we want to bring this out, many of the patients or their parents who were asked to participate in the study chose not to because there's this stigma about depression.
I'm so glad you brought up this issue of stigma, Rick, just because after Robin Williams' suicide, we've certainly been paying some attention to this issue. And this idea of stigma came out during the discussion and all the media frenzy surrounding his death. I don't really have any preconceived notions about people who have depression, so I was rather insensitive to that. And now I feel like I've been sensitized and paying more attention.
Yeah, in fact, it's highlighted in this particular study because about two-thirds of them did not complete the depression screening, and half the time it's because the parents refused to give consent. They just didn't want to even acknowledge it was a possibility.
Wow, something we need to get on the radar. So in view of that, I was going to do the self-management of hypertension in the blog, but instead I'll do this study. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.